If you love true crime and dark stories, then you'll love our other podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia, with new episodes every Monday and Tuesday.
He told them that in the year prior to Bundy's move to Utah, she had discovered objects that she couldn't understand in her house and in Bundy's apartment. These items included crutches and a meat cleaver that was never used for cooking.
Just search Dark Side of Wikipedia wherever you download podcasts.
You know, then this guy gets rich and he has some issues with sexual addiction.
Yeah, and control.
Yeah.
The Keith Raniere story.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Press subscribe wherever you download podcasts and don't miss a single episode.
In some ways, it starts to make things like Jeffrey Dahmer and that look tame, not in terms of the brutality of what they performed, but in terms of the psychology and manipulation of people.
Dark Side of Wikipedia. Available wherever you download podcasts. In the hot summer of 1976, a killer lurked in the shadows of New York City. A killer that would take part in 8 separate shooting attacks and earning him the name Son of Sam. Who was the Son of Sam and what were the motives for his killing spree? Today on the Dark Side of Wikipedia, we continue into the dark story of David Berkowitz, the Son of Sam, Part 2.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
David Richard Berkowitz, the Son of Sam. Part 2, continued from the previous episode. On June 26, 1977, there was another shooting. Sal Lupo, a mechanics helper, 20, and Judy Placido, a recent high school graduate, 17, had left the Ephes discotheque in Bayside, Queens, and were sitting in Lupo's parked car at about 3 a.m. when 3 gunshots blasted through the vehicle. Lupo was wounded in the right forearm, while Placido was shot in the right temple, shoulder, and back of the neck. Both victims survived their injuries. Lupo told police that the young couple had been discussing the Son of Sam case only moments before the shooting. Neither Lupo nor Placido had neither seen their attacker, but 2 witnesses reported a tall, dark-haired man in a leisure suit fleeing from the area. One claimed to see him leave a car and even supplied a partial license plate number. The first anniversary of the initial .44 caliber shootings was approaching, and police established a sizable dragnet and emphasized past hunting grounds in Queens and Bronx. However, the next final .44 shooting occurred in Brooklyn. On early June 31, 1977, Stacy Moskowitz, a secretary, and Robert Vellante, a clothing store salesman, both 20, were in Vellante's car, which was parked under a streetlight near the city park in the neighborhood of Bath Beach, on their first date. They were kissing when a man approached within 3 feet of the passenger side of Vellante's car and fired 4 rounds into the car, striking both victims in the head before he escaped into the park. Vellante lost his left eye. Berkowitz, the only blonde victim of Berkowitz, died from her injuries. That night, Detective John Pulticio was awakened at home and told to report to the 10th Homicide Division in the 60th Precinct Station House in Coney Island. He was given 2 weeks to work on the Moskowitz and Vellante case as a normal murder investigation. If it could not be solved in that time frame, it was to be given to the Son of Sam Task Force. Local resident Cecilia Davis was walking her dog at the scene of the Moskowitz and Vellante shooting when she saw Patrol Officer Michael Catino ticketing a car that was parked near a fire hydrant. Moments after the traffic police had left, a young man walked past her from the area of the car, and he seemed to study her with some interest. Davis felt concerned because he was wielding in his hand some kind of dark object. She ran to her home only to hear shots fired behind her in the street. Davis remained silent about this experience for 4 days until she finally contacted police, who closely checked every car that had been ticketed in the area that night. Berkowitz's 1974 door yellow Ford Galaxy was among the cars that they investigated. On August 9, 1977, NYPD Detective James Justice telephoned Yonkers Police to ask them to schedule an interview with Berkowitz. The Yonkers police dispatcher, who first took Justice's call, was Wheat Carr, the daughter of Sam Carr and sister of Berkowitz's alleged cult confederates, John and Michael Carr. Justice asked the Yonkers police for some help tracking down Berkowitz. According to Mike Navanti, the sergeant of the Yonkers Police Department, the Yonkers police had their own suspicions about Berkowitz in connection with other strange crimes in Yonkers. Crimes they saw referred to in one of the Son of Sam letters. Yonkers investigators even told the New York City detective that Berkowitz might just be the Son of Sam. The next day, on August 10, 1977, police investigated Berkowitz's car that was parked on the street outside his apartment building at 35 Pine Street in Yonkers. They saw a rifle in the back seat. They searched the car and found a duffel bag filled with ammunition, maps of crime scenes, and a threatening letter addressed to Inspector Timothy Dowd of the Omega Task Force. Police decided to wait for Berkowitz to leave the apartment rather than risk a violent encounter in the building's narrow hallway. They also waited to obtain a search warrant for the apartment, worried that their search might be challenged in court. The initial search of the vehicle was based on the rifle that was visible in the back seat, although possession of such a rifle was legal in New York State and required no special permit. The warrant still had not arrived when Berkowitz exited the apartment building at about 10 p.m. and entered his car. Detective John Faltasio approached the driver's side of the car. Faltasio pointed his gun close to Berkowitz's temple, while Detective Sergeant William Gardella pointed his gun from the passenger side. A paper bag containing a .44 caliber Bulldog revolver of the type that was identified in ballistics tests was found next to Berkowitz in the car. Berkowitz then stated flatly, "Well, you got me." As described in Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner, Detective Faltasio remembered the big, inexplicable smile on the man's face. "Now that I've got you," Detective Faltasio said to the suspect, "who have I got?" "You know," the man said. And what the detective remembered was a soft, almost sweet voice. "No, I don't. You tell me." The man turned his head and said, "I'm Sam." "You're Sam? Sam who?" "Sam, David Berkowitz." An alternate version claimed that Berkowitz's first words were reported to be, "Well, you got me. How come it took you such a long time?" Detective John Faltasio was officially credited by the NYPD as the arresting officer of the Son of Sam. Police searched Department 7E and found it in disarray with satanic graffiti on the walls. They also found diaries that he had kept since he was 21 years old, three stenographers' notebooks, nearly a full, wherein Berkowitz meticulously noted hundreds of arsons that he claimed to have set throughout New York City. Some sources allege this number might be over 1,400. Soon after Berkowitz's arrest, the address of the building was changed from 35 Pine Street to 42 Pine Street, an attempt to end its notoriety. After the arrest, Berkowitz was briefly held in a Yonkers police station before being transported directly to the 60th Precinct in Coney Island, where the detective's task force was located. At about 1 a.m., Mayor Abraham Boehm arrived to see the suspect personally. After a brief and wordless encounter, he announced to the media, "The people of the city of New York can rest easy because of the fact that the police have captured a man who they believe to be the Son of Sam." So it's got to be somewhat comforting at this point to at least think you got the guy. You're going to go with that and hope that you're accurate, as there's been people who've made fake confessions in the past, but it seems this one's, the evidence kind of points in that direction. It's the dark side of Wikipedia as we continue the David Richard Berkowitz Son of Sam story. Tony and Sean continuing with you on this dark journey. Thoughts thus far?
I think there's a collective sigh of relief, a large breath by all precincts throughout that area. Finally, we got him. Does that detective have a party thrown for him? Is it a pizza party next week at work for him? Thanks for finally arresting him.
Do you think it's a pizza party? Or, I mean, probably depends on the budget of the year. You know, if the budget's kind of not good, it's like, well, we got donuts for the morning and a box of coffee here that really only about seven of you are going to get a cup. But, hey, you know, it's something.
I know there's 52 here in the precinct, but who brought a 12-pack of donuts?
Yeah, it's something like that. And then by the time he gets there, they're like all gone and like, "Oh, we got your donuts." That could be.
I'm not insinuating that you can be a psychic and you have to not live your life, but if you know of a murderer going around that specifically targets couples, and specifically targets couples in their car, and specifically targets couples in their car late at night or early in the morning, would you hang out with a dude on your first date at 3 a.m. in a car?
No, I would not. But there are so many things in this world that baffle the imagination of what risks people will take that are completely unnecessary and completely preventable, but they still continue to take them.
I'm just a bit baffled, because if I'm thinking to myself, this is the late 70s and out on the prowl and looking for a lady friend and meet a lady friend and, hey, it went great. We got a beverage. Let's go in my car. Let's go to a park and let's just talk about life till late at night. Even though in the news and in the paper, there's this man that, yeah, let's just talk about life. I really want to get to know you more. Even though there's this serial killer that's shooting people at random in random cars late at night, let's really connect later. I probably shouldn't take you home, and we could meet at the park in daylight tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, at the same argument, and I'm not getting political, but it's just the reality of things. You have a virus that's killing more people than 9/11 on a daily basis. And yet I feel, or not me, but some people are like, well, you know what? Let's go to the giant superstore with no mask that's surrounded by tons of other people. Notice many are wearing masks. But you know what? I'm just going to take my chances because, hey, there's nothing going on. It's people have this way of thinking, and I think it's a coping mechanism. Not that it's healthy or productive or good or anything like that, even though science shows you that something like this, in this case, you know, masks, they don't completely prevent it, but they cut it your risk down. Not sitting in your car late at night with a lover in the very specific geographical area where people have been being shot, I would think your risk would go down if you didn't put yourself in that situation as well. But I think some people like to, not that they like to, I think they almost, it's almost like this need for normalcy, and the normalcy urge will take over the sanity urge. And that's what ends up winning out.
It's funny, as we went down this road about 4 minutes ago on the show, I thought, not going to turn it into wearing a mask or not. Just going to ride the wave. And there it was.
Because I fucking hate people.
So
don't just do what makes sense.
And if anything, what we are learning in this tragic story of those people that lost their life is common sense is anything but common. Yeah. And here in the year of 2020, even though the show is airing into the next year, it's not that 2020 showed us that there are so many stupid people. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, it just shined an even brighter spotlight on the selfishness of people.
Yeah,
and what they will choose to do. There were these people back in 1977, people back in 1877, there have been less than intelligent decisions by a high number of people forever.
It's a matter of
us realizing, oh my God, that's a dumb decision. When the hell did that come from? It's always been there.
There just happens to be times in history where the spotlight ends up shining brighter, and then we see them more frequently. And then it eventually moves away. And then you just kind of get into this comfort stage of, oh no, people will do the right thing, until it's like, oh shit, people aren't doing the right thing. Different, obviously, whole set of scenarios here, but, you know, preventable. Don't put yourself in that situation. I'm not blaming the victim here, but it's just like, you know, be a little more vigilant when shit like that's going down, and you may not fall victim to it.
So for folks that tune in that maybe are members of law enforcement, and maybe you enjoy listening to this show to kind of have a stress reliever, maybe you're going through an investigation and you're trying to crack the case. How enjoyable do you believe, from a detective standpoint, that would be when they go up to that car and they find out that they found their guy? I would imagine there was a sense of, Fuck yes.
Yeah.
We gotcha.
I would think so. And imagine if you got him and everything pointed to him, and then somehow someone else came out and said, that's impossible. It couldn't be him because he was over here the other night and there was evidence about it. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later because I'm watching a docuseries about this other character that we'll do an episode on here eventually about. But in Texas, there was a guy that the documentary is called The Confession Killer. And the guy like admitted to like 200 some murders throughout the state of Texas. And the police like took him around. The Texas Rangers took him around to spot to spot to spot. And he seemed to be like, yep. And this is how it happened. And he was, it's almost like how sometimes psychics will bullshit you when they're not really psychics, but they kind of get you to keep going along with
I sense you had a mother. Did you have a mother?
Where it's like, yes,
you had a mother.
She was sitting over here,
sitting over there and she was wearing a
shirt.
She was wearing a shirt.
But he went around, and Henry Lee Lucas is his name, and he confessed to all these cases, and the Texas Rangers were thrilled because they were closing like 200 murder cases that were just sitting open that they had not yet solved. And then it turns out people started coming forward going, there's no way in hell this man killed my insert person here, my sister, daughter, whatever. Because he was like in jail in another state at the time or this or that. And then there was this whole battle between the law enforcement of Texas that didn't want to have all these cases that they just closed reopened, because we're talking hundreds of them that they thought, you know, we've closed the case on this. We already had the fucking pizza party for catching this guy. We can't go back and undo the pizza party. So we're just going to say that he did it. And it came all the way down to like him being on death row and him saying, no, I made all this shit up. I can prove I made all this shit up. And they were still down to the last minute, like, maybe we'll just kill you anyway. And anyway, it's an interesting one, not this story, but one that we can talk about. But it does come to mind when you have people that are caught and you go, okay, even if they are confessing, are they really the guy? In this case, with Berkowitz, I believe he was the guy, but that could be, you know, pretty catastrophic if he wasn't.
Well, that feeling of accomplishment and yes, we got him has now turned into an overwhelming sense of paranoia.
Yeah.
Well, shit, is anybody that I apprehend truly the person?
Exactly. I mean, it can just, you go down a rabbit hole and you don't know what, you know, what is reality. Let's continue into the story and into his confession. Berkowitz was interrogated for about 30 minutes in the early morning of August 11, 1977. He quickly confessed to the shooting and expressed an interest in pleading guilty. The investigation was led by John Keenan, who took the confession. During questioning, Berkowitz claimed that his neighbor's dog was one of the reasons that he killed, stating that the dog demanded the blood of pretty young girls. He said that the Sam mentioned in his first letter was his former neighbor, Sam Carr. Berkowitz claimed that Harvey, Carr's black Labrador retriever, was possessed by an ancient demon and that it issued irresistible commands that Berkowitz must kill people. A few weeks after his arrest and confession, Berkowitz was permitted to communicate with the press. In a letter to the New York Post dated September 19, 1977, Berkowitz alluded to his original story of demonic possession, but closed with a warning that has been interpreted by some investigators as an admission of criminal accomplices. There are other sons out there. God help the world. At a press conference in February 1979, however, Berkowitz declared that his previous claims of demonic possession were a hoax. Berkowitz stated in a series of meetings with his special court-appointed psychiatrist David Abramson that he had long contemplated murder to get revenge in a world that he felt had rejected and hurt him. Sentencing and prison sentencing. Three separate mental health examinations determined that Berkowitz was competent to stand trial. Despite this, defense lawyers advised Berkowitz to enter a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, but Berkowitz refused. He appeared calm in court on May 8, 1978, as he pled guilty to all of the shootings. At his sentencing 2 weeks later, Berkowitz caused an uproar when he attempted to jump out of a window of the seventh-floor courtroom. After he was restrained, he repeatedly chanted Stacy, his victim's last name, was a whore, and shouted, I'd kill her again. I'd kill them all again. The court ordered another psychiatric examination before sentencing could proceed. During the evaluation, Berkowitz drew a sketch of a jailed man surrounded by numerous walls. At the bottom wrote, I am not well, not well at all. Nonetheless, Berkowitz was found competent to stand trial. On June 12, 1978, Berkowitz was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison for each murder to be served consecutively. He was ordered to serve time in Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York Supermax Prison. Despite prosecutors' objections to terms of Berkowitz's guilty plea, made him eligible for parole in 25 years. After his arrest, Berkowitz was initially confined to a psychiatric ward in Kings County Hospital, where the staff reported that he seemed remarkably troubled by his new environment. On the day after his sentencing, he was taken first to the Sing Sing prison and then to the upstate Clinton Correctional Facility for psychiatric and physical examinations. Two more months were spent at the Central New York Psychiatric Center in Marcy before his admission to Attica Prison. Berkowitz served about a decade in Attica until he was relocated to Sullivan Correctional Facility in Fallsburg, where he remained for many years until he was transferred to Shawangunk Correctional Facility in Ulster County. Berkowitz described life in Attica as a nightmare. In 1979, there was an attempt on Berkowitz's life in which the left side of his neck was slashed from front to back, resulting in a wound that required more than 50 stitches to close. Berkowitz refused to identify his assailant and only claimed that he was grateful for the attack. It brought a sense of justice, or in Berkowitz's own words, the punishment I deserve. In 1987, Berkowitz became an evangelical Christian in prison. According to his personal testimony, the moment of conversion occurred after reading Psalm 34:6 from a Bible given to him by a fellow inmate. He says he is no longer to be referred to as Son of Sam, but Son of Hope. Soon after his imprisonment, Berkowitz invited Malachi Martin, an exorcist, to help him compose an autobiography, but the offer was not accepted. During later years, Berkowitz developed his memoirs with assistance from evangelical Christians. His statements were released in an interview video, Son of Hope, during 1998, with more extensive work released in book form, entitled Son of Hope, The Prison Journals of David Berkowitz. Berkowitz does not receive any royalties or profit from any sales of his works. He has continued to write essays on faith and repentance for Christian websites. His own official website is maintained on behalf by a church group, since he's not allowed access to a computer. Berkowitz stays involved with prison ministry and regularly counsels troubled inmates. While in the Sullivan facility, he pursued education and graduated with honors from Sullivan Community College. Berkowitz is entitled to a parole hearing every 2 years as mandated by state law, though he has consistently refused to ask for his release, sometimes skipping the hearings altogether. Before his first parole hearing in 2002, Berkowitz sent a letter to New York Governor George Pataki demanding that it be canceled. He wrote, "In all honesty, I believe that I deserve to be in prison for the rest of my life. I have, with God's help, long ago come to terms with my situation and have accepted my punishment." Officials at the Sullivan facility rejected his demand. In his 2016 hearing at Shawangunk, New York, Berkowitz stated that while parole was unrealistic, he felt he had improved himself behind bars, adding, "I feel I am no risk whatsoever." His lawyer, Mark Heller, noted that prison staff considered Berkowitz to be a model prisoner. In 2018, the board again denied the release of Berkowitz on parole. His next hearing was scheduled for May of 2020. The coronavirus in 2019 delayed his hearing until further notice. In 2002, during the D.C. sniper attacks, Berkowitz wrote a letter telling the sniper to stop hurting innocent people. Berkowitz made his comments in a three-page letter to Rita Cosby, senior Chicago correspondent for Fox News Channel, after Cosby wrote him seeking his comment on the sniper attacks. During June 2005, Berkowitz sued one of his previous lawyers for the misappropriation of a large number of his letters, photographs, and other personal possessions. Hugo Harmatz, a New Jersey attorney, and represented Berkowitz in an earlier legal effort to prevent the National Enquirer from buying one of his letters. Harmatz then self-published his own collection of letters and memorabilia, Dear David, which he had obtained from Berkowitz during their consultations. Berkowitz stated that he would drop the lawsuit only if the attorney signed over all the money he made to the victims' families. In October 2006, Berkowitz and Harmatz settled out of court, with Harmatz agreeing to return the disputed items and to donate part of his book profits to the New York State Crime Victims Board. In 1979, Berkowitz mailed a book about witchcraft to police in North Dakota. He had underlined several passages and written a few marginal notes, including the phrase, "Arliss Perry, hunted, stalked, and slain," followed to California Stanford University. The reference was to Arliss Perry, a 19-year-old North Dakota newlywed who had been murdered at Stanford on October 12, 1974. Her death and the notorious abuse of her corpse in a Christian chapel on campus was a widely reported case. Berkowitz mentioned Perry's attack in other letters, suggesting he knew details of it from the perpetrator himself. Local police investigators interviewed him, but they now believe he has nothing of value to offer. The Arliss Perry case has since been solved. After his admission to Sullivan Prison, Berkowitz began to claim that he had joined a satanic cult in the spring of 75. In 1993, Berkowitz made these claims, known when he announced to a press that he had killed only three of the Son of Sam victims, Donna Luria, Alexander Esau, and Valentina Serini. In his revised version of the events, Berkowitz said that other shooters were involved and that he fired the gun only in the first attack and the six. He said that he and several other cult members were involved in every incident by planning the events, providing early surveillance to the victims, and acting as lookouts and drivers at the crime scenes. Berkowitz stated that he could not divulge the names of most of his accomplices without putting his family directly at risk. Among Berkowitz's alleged unnamed associates was a female cult member whom he claimed fired the gun at Durano and Keenan, both of whom survived. Berkowitz said because the alleged accomplice was unfamiliar with the power of recoil of a .44 Bulldog, Berkowitz declared that at least five cult members were at the scene of the Freund Deal shooting, but the actual shooter was a prominent cult associate who had been brought in from outside New York with an unspecified motive, a cult member whom he identified only as the nickname Mason 2. Another unnamed person was a gunman in the Moskowitz-Valentini case, a male cult member who had arrived from North Dakota for the occasion, also without explanation. Berkowitz did name two of the other cult members, John and Michael Carr. The two men were sons of the dog-owner Sam Carr, and they lived in nearby Warburton Avenue. Both of these other sons of Sam were long dead. John Carr had been killed by a shooting judged a suicide in North Dakota during 1978, and Michael Carr had been in a fatal car accident in 1979. Berkowitz claimed that the actual perpetrator of the DeMasi-Lamino shooting was John Carr, and he added that a Yonkers police officer, also a cult member, was involved in the crime. He claimed that Michael Carr fired the shots at Lupo and Placido. Journalist John Hockenberry asserts that even aside from the satanic cult claims, many officials doubted the single shooter story, writing, "What most don't know about the Son of Sam case is that from the beginning, not everyone bought the idea that Berkowitz acted alone." John Santucci, Queens District Attorney at the time of the killings, and police investigator Mike Noventy both expressed their convictions that Berkowitz had accomplices. NYPD officer Richard Johnson, involved in the original investigations, had opined that unresolved discrepancies in statements from witnesses and surviving victims indicate Berkowitz did not act alone. Why are there three suspect cars, five different descriptions, different heights, different shapes, different sizes of the perpetrator? Somebody else was there. Other contemporaries have voiced their belief in the satanic cult theory, including Donna Lorena's father and Carl Durano, who stated his opinion that more than one person was involved, but admitted he could not prove the cult theory. Durano's conclusion rests on his criticism of Berkowitz's statement to police as totally false. John Deal's recollection is that he physically bumped into Berkowitz outside the Wine Gallery restaurant as he and Christine Freund departed and walked to his car while the shooting occurred. Berkowitz, in contrast, told police that he passed within a few feet of Deal and Freund shortly before they entered the car. Deal contends that he and Freund passed no one on their way to the car, and further, that placement of the car parked at the curb would have made it impossible for Berkowitz to have snuck up on them in a few minutes between their encounter outside the restaurant and the shooting at the car. Deal thus reasons he was shot by someone other than Berkowitz. Hockenberry's own report was broadcast by Network News and given exposure by Dateline NBC. In it, he discusses another journalist, Maury Terry, who had begun investigating the Son of Sam shootings before Berkowitz was arrested. Terry published a series of investigative articles in the Gannett newspapers in 1979, which challenged the official explanation of the lone gunman. Vigorously denied by police at the time, Terry's articles were widely read and discussed. They were later assembled in the book form as The Ultimate Evil, largely impelled by these reports of accomplices in satanic cult activity. The Son of Sam case was reopened by Yonkers police during 1996, but no new charges were filed. Due to a lack of findings, the investigation was eventually suspended, but remains open. From prison, Berkowitz continues to assert and expand upon his claims of demonic possession. He stated in a series of 9 videos in 2015 that the voice he heard was that of a Durid devil, the true origin of the Son of Sam. He added that it never was a dog, saying that detail was fabricated by the media. Berkowitz later claims were dismissed by many. Breslin rejected his story of satanic cult accomplices, stating that when they talked to David Berkowitz that night, he recalled everything step by step. The guy has 1,000% recall, and that's it. He's a guy, and there's nothing else to look at. Skeptics include former FBI profiler Johnny Douglas, who spent hours interviewing Berkowitz. He states that he was convinced Berkowitz acted alone and was introverted, a loner, not capable of being involved in group activity. NYPD psychologist Dr. Harvey Schlossenberg states in Against the Law, a documentary about the Son of Sam case, that he believes that the satanic cult claims are nothing but a fantasy concocted by Berkowitz to absolve himself of the crimes. In his book, Hunting Humans, Elliot Layton argued that recent journalistic attempts to abridge or even deny Berkowitz's guilt have lacked all credibility. Decades after his arrest, the name Son of Sam remains widely recognized as that of the notorious serial killer. Many manifestations in popular culture have helped perpetrate this novelty, while Berkowitz himself continues to express remorse on Christian websites. Nayessa Moskowitz, who previously had not hidden her hatred of Berkowitz, wrote him a letter shortly before her own death in 2006, forgiving him for killing her daughter Stacy. In a sad twist of fate, Moskowitz lost all her children at young ages. She had no survivors except, according to the New York Post, her daughter's murderer. That is rather sad. We're at the end. All you have as you're about to pass is writing a letter to the guy who killed one of your children. What are your thoughts on all of the his allegations, his stories of satanic rituals and being possessed and this and that? You know, we hear about things like that on the ghost shows, not so much in the context of, you know, serial killers and things of that nature, but people who do seem to come under those sort of, I don't know what the right word would be other than possession. But do you think that that really is something with this case, or is it just some sort of, you know, extra fabrication that he made up because it would get him some more attention and make the case even more lurid to the public?
Yeah, I think 2020, all of us have had a little bit more time to think. Maybe all of us have been a little bit more bored than ever in our lives. And we realize the mind, when it is not being used, is very interesting. Yeah. So if you think to yourself, you're in prison, you have opportunities to concoct theories, and you can write letters, and you can make others, well, oh, so what about this, that, and then it gets momentum, and all of a sudden there's this whole satanic cult claim. I, quite honestly, not being a psychiatrist and not being in his brain, ultimately I have absolutely no idea, but I'd like to think that what he has done in prison and what he has tried to accomplish, that the origin, I think there may be some truth to it, but I think it's just a fabrication, and the mind kind of thinks of its own things. And then once you get addicted to a thought, you can make more of it than what it really is.
Yeah. It's always troubling to me, and I'm not knocking religion. I'm fine.
But let me go ahead and knock religion. But
let me knock religion. It's not knocking religion. It's more so posing a question. It's okay. So let's say you were murdered by David Berkowitz. And now Berkowitz, after killing a bunch of people and saying a bunch of crazy shit in prison, finds God. And now he's born again. And okay, he dies eventually. And now everybody's in heaven together. And guess who you bump into? David Berkowitz. I don't see how this works. I don't see how this works out well, that someone who did shit like this bad, can just have it all kind of washed away and then everybody goes to the same place. I know that's what, like, religion or organized religion somewhat teaches, but to me, it just doesn't fucking square up. And I'm just going to write it off to I don't understand it. I don't have the answer as to how this works, because I don't.
But the simplistic version that I learned in Sunday school would have Berkowitz showing up, you know, at the same buffet line as the people he killed. And I think it's probably far more complex than that, if that is in fact what happens. But to me, when you go off of just kind of basically the stuff that you were, you know, taught in Sunday school, it doesn't square up when you put people like this together. It's just, it doesn't make any sense. Thoughts?
Well, yes, to answer your question bluntly, I would agree with how it doesn't make sense. But what's more interesting to me, and again, I don't know if I have enough of the knowledge to analyze it, but what then is the difference of going to heaven mm-hmm. or going to hell? And in my, what I know, I mean, if you kill someone and you kill multiple people and you're cognizant of doing it mm-hmm. like that, that would then, okay, you sir die. All right, let's see, elevator. I'm going to press the up button. No. Press the down button. You're going to go to hell. So he wouldn't, in theory, be at the buffet line of all of us in heaven. He would be in a different with the Jeffrey Dahmer sorts of such, well, at that, the buffet line.
That's the problem, because it depends then on the version of your religion that you're talking about, or Christianity, which is what he converted to. And some would flat out say that, yes, anything in the world that anyone has ever done is forgivable. And this is according to the dogma of it. Some versions would have places where, no, not everything is forgivable. And there are certain things that cannot be. So it all depends on what you subscribe to. But there are certainly many that subscribe to, no matter what you do, no matter what it is, it can still be forgivable. And I don't want to believe that. I don't want to believe that there's a Jeffrey Dahmer hanging out in heaven if I ever get there. I don't want to believe that the BTK killer is there, or that David Berkowitz is eventually going to be hanging out there too. That doesn't seem fair to me. That doesn't seem right to me. I don't give a fuck if you changed your life around after you did all these things. Good for you. Then you're not going to be hurting other people. Good. But guess what? You already took the life of all these other people. So here's your fucking consequence. You are now completely worthless in this universe and will be forevermore. I don't know. I mean, that's my, I guess, dark, twisted, fuck the world view of it, or fuck people that are, you know, just unredeemable. When you're like this, there's just unredeemable people. But that's the dogma of Tony. That's not necessarily, you know, based on any one specific, you know, religion. But again, it also says we're not there to judge either. So, you know, but I guess I would like to hope that people like that are fucked when it comes to the pearly gates.
I guess for me, what the ultimate question is that I don't have the answer to, if that is indeed the case and everything is forgivable and for I have sinned, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, then why is there hell? Like, why is there hell? Well, is forgivable and everything can, instead of the other.
I mean, I'm not trying to turn this into a religious but I was brought up Lutheran and I was brought up in, you know, in parochial school. So I had like years of this, you know, jammed into my head. So I have some knowledge here on how the belief system goes. Basically, you have to ask for the forgiveness. You have to, according to this, according to the dogma, all of it, you have to recognize that you did something wrong and then ask for forgiveness. And according to this story, Berkowitz has done that, which would then give him, according to some versions of Christianity, he's got the pass. He's good. He's going to be there at the fucking buffet line next to everybody else in heaven. But that to me is where it's just like, I think there's something wrong with this thinking. I just don't think that this is quite how it works out. But again, it's not a religious show. I'm not here to say this is right or this is wrong, but it doesn't square up with what I was taught as a child, you know, going through that. Not like they jumped into like, and now we're going to discuss how serial killers get to heaven. You know, it was more so we had coloring paper out and there was coloring books and we got to draw Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt as they ran away from their town that was burning in Sodom and Gomorrah. And God found it fit to turn his wife into a pillar of salt because she wanted to look back one last time. So boom, your wife is a pillar of salt. It sounds like a lovely, lovely way to escape.
Where, I told you to let me use the remote control. Gosh darn it.
Where's now that Judy? You didn't,
boom.
Judy's back there. There's that cattle licking on her because she's a salt block now. Like, that to me was like, holy shit, really? Just because you looked back, I commanded you not to turn around and look. You turned her into fucking salt?
Phil, that's a nice new ficus you got there. Where'd you get that? Home Goods? No, that's Judy.
Just like
that's Judy.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of but you know, again, I'm not trying to bash religion. Just all I can do and say to have any semblance of it in my life is just to say I don't understand, and I think that's fair. Because I don't think we're supposed to. I don't understand. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying, you know what? There's certain things I'm just not going to understand. And I don't think that necessarily has to take away from like the core goodness that some of that offers. If I don't understand all of the meticulous details of every witch story that's been translated 500 witch times for every witch language and every witch government, that story is necessarily super clear in terms of how we would understand it today. That's kind of where I sit on all that.
I think there's an agreement in that, and there is a large amount that we both do not understand. But to bring it back to this specific story with Berkowitz, I think that as many murderers as there have been in time and will be, mm-hmm. a certain percentage of them, similar to people who have not killed anyone, I think there can be cold-blooded individuals who have zero remorse. They are angry people, and they will take that to their grave. I also think there are people that go through bad times in life that then when they're in prison for 40 years, they then have opportunities to reflect. Mm-hmm. And they may be good people. I'm not insinuating it gives them a pass because they killed people, but or multiple people. But what I'm saying is they then have time to reflect. They then want to become whether it be a born-again Christian or a model prisoner or just, hey, guess what? I fucked up. I killed 4 people. Like, I'm done. It is not forgivable. But the rest of the time that I have on Earth, everybody that I come into contact with, I'm going to have regret. I'm going to have remorse. And then I think there's other people who don't. So
yeah.
That is nothing to do with religion, but just to somewhat make sense how people that do such tragic and terrible and you can't even describe things. How then can they come across as you hear stories of, you know, a prison guard say they're model prisoners?
Yeah.
What? They killed 9 people. Well, yeah, that was 30 years ago. And they're not a emotionless, feelingless person.
Yeah.
Opposed to someone that is a recluse and terrible until the day they die.
Yeah, I'll give him credit for being a good prisoner and trying to help others. They get credit there, but at the same point, it doesn't erase what was done. And I think he realizes that too. So that's, you know, that's good. But yeah, it's just like, holy shit. Although I'm not like really big up on the let's keep digging into the I think the devil made me do it type thing when you've already admitted you made it up and now, oh, I'm going to say it again because it seems to get some attention. That to me kind of, you're going back to your old ways. Let's go back to the model citizen type thing and let's just stop talking about the shit that you did. And let's just kind of, you do good and maybe you can help some other, you know, shitheads in here turn their ways around. I don't know. But I thought he was dead, actually. I was kind of surprised to learn that he's still alive and kicking.
I was waiting for you to get to the point of his death, and then I realized, wait a minute, he's not dead.
He's still there. He is still kicking it. So there you go.
Road trip.
Let's go. Was it David?
I am Berkowitz? Here to see Dave.
Sam?
Berkowitz?
Yeah. Hey, let's have we've got some pizza. Jesus. It's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like the show, be sure to keep us on the air. And you do that by pressing subscribe, letting your friends know that we exist wherever you download podcasts. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. Workplace stress is now a leading cause of declining mental health, with 61% of the global workforce feeling it more than ever. You can't escape work, but you can take small steps to care for yourself. A walk, some sun, a favorite song. Therapy is one of those steps, ongoing support to build resilience for whatever your day throws at you. Balance is tough. Getting help shouldn't be. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today for 10% off your first month.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In The News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.